Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, our very special guest is Bernice Hewson. Bernice is founder of Raising Racial Consciousness, which is dedicated to challenging conventional thinking to build a racially equitable society. Bernice is an accredited coach and an emotional intelligence practitioner, and she holds a psychosocial MA in race, empire, and post-coloniality. With 15 years of corporate leadership, Bernice emphasizes that lasting change begins with individuals and that racially conscious leadership is essential if we're going to make any progress. Bernice, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. Great to see you here. How are you today?
Thank you, Simon. I'm good. I'm really glad to be here. Yeah, really excited and looking forward to a conversation with you.
Great. So let's begin with how you came to this work. Can you say something about your journey, about how you arrived to where you are today?
Yeah, and it was a journey, to be honest. Maybe if I start a little bit with identity. You know, I identify as a Black woman of mixed heritage. So my dad is from Barbados. My mum is white British. I very much grew up in all white spaces at school, at university, in the workplace. And I grew up with very strong meritocratic ideals, which for me, you know, life was very much about head down, work hard, you know, do the things you're meant to do and progress. And I did that, and that was great. And it worked for a while. And I think it stopped working probably, I don't know, maybe 12, 15 years ago now. And I think there was a combination of things. I had children, and I think that changes your outlook on life and you start questioning things. But there was also lots of kind of social, political events happening in the world. I remember really vividly in 2015, there was an image on the front page of most papers of a 3-year-old Syrian boy, refugee. Yeah. I don't know if you remember, his name was Alan Kurdi, and he had drowned in a migrant crossing.
Yeah.
And it really, really disturbed me and stuck with me. And I had a 3-year-old at the time, and it really made me just go, you know, kind of start questioning things that, to be honest, I hadn't paid attention to, because I'd just been focused on me and my little world and progressing and battling things at, you know, my own kind of individual level. But I think things like that, things like the Brexit referendum, which very much was kind of fought on anti-immigration rhetoric, Grenfell fire, you know, lots of these events were happening, and I was becoming more and more kind of detached from the work I was doing, where I was putting my energies. And I was actually struggling to make sense of everything that was happening in the world, to be honest. I didn't have the knowledge or awareness to kind of make sense of it, or know what my part was in it. And, you know, there was a seminal moment for me, which there was for lots of people, when George Floyd was murdered, which really forced me to kind of sit back and pay attention. I had a workplace that was kind of saying to me, Bernice, you know, what should we do? What should we do to, you know, solve systemic racism? It's like, I've got no idea. I actually have no idea how you should respond in this moment. I'm kind of quite traumatized. And I think the other significant thing that happened at that time, I don't know if you'll recall, because it didn't hit the news in the same way, but there was an incident in New York in Central Park with a lady called Amy Cooper. And she was walking her dog through an area called the Rambles, and her dog wasn't on the lead. And there was a Black guy in this area, a bird watcher. His name was Christian Cooper. They just so happened to have the same surname. And he asked this lady to put her dog on the lead because it was in violation of whatever rule or policy. And she responded quite quickly and quite hysterically and said, you know, no, I'm not going to do this, and I'm going to call 911. And I'm going to tell the police that there's an African-American man threatening me. And this incident really disturbed me, because what I kind of witnessed in, because the whole thing was filmed, so this guy filmed this incident. I witnessed a woman who knew the power of her racial identity in the moment, and the kind of ability and ease and speed at which she felt she could kind of call the police. Yeah. and use this kind of state power to say, you know, come and save me from this guy. But also what really interested me was the fact that this guy was switched on enough to know he needed to remain calm. He needed to film the incident. And actually, I listened to an interview of him afterwards, and he spoke about how he very often wears glasses when he's out walking, because he knows that that makes his identity as a black man less threatening.
Yeah.
And so this moment for me was a kind of like, race is so much more than an identity. Like, it's this power, it's this force that's operating. She knew what she was doing in that moment. He knew what was happening in that moment. Yet we don't kind of talk about these dynamics. And so, I mean, I spent hours thinking about this incident. I discussed it with my sister. I discussed it with friends. And it was 2 weeks later that I quit my career. And I can remember doing circles of my garden, thinking like, pros and cons, do I, don't I? And I really had reached that point where I felt that, firstly, I wanted answers. So I wanted to go and do some kind of sense making and meaning making of all of these kind of events that I was witnessing. And also I felt very like unmoored from what I understood the world to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I now have the language that what Frantz Fanon would say is the decolonization of the mind, right? Where you are kind of, all of the ways that you see and understand the world suddenly become shattered, and you have this space where you're kind of saying, so now what?
Yeah.
And so it's at that point that I decided to sign up for this master's at Birkbeck, culture, diaspora and ethnicity. And that really was a huge turning point for me. I mean, I did it with no real understanding of what would come from that. And I was fortunate enough that I could take a year out and go and do that work. I had young kids, so I had a very romantic idea that I'd be homeschooling and studying, and it was actually horrendous. I'll never do it again. But, you know, it kind of led me on the path to where I am now, which was to really kind of, I guess, do that sense making, have the skills and capability to understand, I don't know, what does identity and belonging and power really mean? How does it work? How does it work through me? And that's what then led me to coaching. That's what then, I had qualified as a coach back in 2017, but it really then led me to relook at coaching as a profession and how I experienced it and the work that we do as coaches.
Yeah. I mean, that's quite a journey. Can you say something about like a pre and a post identity? I mean, you talk about raising racial consciousness, and it's a language I use a lot. Like, more recently, I'm talking more and more about consciousness raising, because, you know, I go back to kind of the ideas of the 1960s, the social movements, feminism, kind of civil rights. And there's a lot of language around consciousness raising then. You don't hear it so much now. So I'm pleased to see it kind of, you mentioned it. But before you kind of had this consciousness raising kind of experience, you describe your life sort of, it sounds a bit like, you know, suburban, kind of like career orientated, you know. How would you describe the differences in your identity in those two kind of two Bernices?
They're huge, to be honest. I think pre the kind of awakening, if you like, I never felt like I quite belonged anywhere. So I felt that I was never quite black enough to kind of relate and fit in with certain aspects of my identity and family. And at the same time, I stood out in the all white spaces that I operated in. So there was often just an underlying feeling of not enoughness, which is why I think people go this route of assimilation, right? And kind of working hard and doing all of these things. And I don't know how even conscious it was. That was just how I kind of operated.
Yeah.
I would say that the experience of, you know, this kind of curiosity that grew and grew to the point that actually I could no longer ignore it, absolutely came from a searching for a sense of understanding myself. Whilst it's become the work I do, it absolutely was a need for me. And I don't know if you've read Paul Gilroy, Black Atlantic. He talks about diasporic identities. So the Black identity doesn't have to be a Black African identity or a Jamaican identity or a Black American or even Black British, but actually it's kind of identities that are shaped with a kind of network of connections between all of those places. And
yeah.
That for me was, that really speaks to me, that idea, because I think even when people talk about a Black British identity, like, what is that? You know, There's a book that was written in 2012, and there was a chapter that it's called Diversity and Coaching. And I think there's a chapter in there that says how to coach Black British people. And I'm like, what does that even mean? And so for me, going on this journey gave me the language to feel that actually my identity is valid. Mm-hmm. It's something that's both where I am today, but it's always becoming, it's always changing. And that's okay. It can be fluid. And actually, I have loads to offer because of that. You know, my experiences carry wealth and knowledge in and of themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think this idea of fluidity is really, really important, because I think people do get boxed in. You know, it's kind of interesting in America, there's a different language. You can be colored or you can be African-American, and in British is Black British, and like, you know, who fits into that boxes? You know, do we put Asians alongside them, inside that? Are they different? Is it, you know, is it kind of a, you know, where are the lines drawn, and kind of like, what does it mean?
Well, exactly. And even terminology like mixed race, which is often used and was very often used when I was younger. Yeah. I'm not a fan of it. Equally, I'm not offended by it, but even the notion of mixed race suggests that there's these pure races, white and black is pure, and then you're this kind of mixed thing in the middle. And it's just, you know, I just found it generally quite unhelpful. And I think, you know, we could debate terminology forever. You know, you could talk BAME, global majority, and all these things. And ultimately, I think it's a case of being clear on your own identity, because actually, you know, frankly, it wastes time debating identities and names and titles, because someone will always disagree. So I think, you know, finding that kind of certainty for yourself and recognizing that actually labels and names do carry power, and you can use them with caution, and you can, you know, we don't need to be kind of seeking the perfect definition. I think it's futile.
I agree. And I, you know, this kind of the idea of fluid identities and moving, like, even in your own life, like, you know, is important. However, like, there's challenges individually to recognize your own identity is one thing, but, you know, we are members of different groups, we are kind of members of you know, and we have our own choices in some of that, and some of it's unconscious, and also we have it projected upon us. You mentioned Frantz Fanon, and that was reading Fanon for me was like absolutely eye-opening. It kind of really changed my understanding of race, and I'm amazed how few people read Fanon, because for me his work is like absolutely fundamental to understanding kind of this, you know, because he takes a he's a psychiatrist as well, and he has this understanding of how we take in the projections of others and how it kind of how it forms us, you know. So all that's going on, it's a heady mix, isn't it, to try and...
It is. And I think, you know, take Fanon as an example, that's where, like, if only we could weave some of that thinking and knowledge and understanding into some of the work that we do around identity, I think it could be so powerful and so helpful. You know, I think, like, racial trauma is very poorly understood and often misdiagnosed as imposter syndrome, right? And I think that there is real steps that we could take to kind of integrate some knowledge from some of those thinkers that are kind of on the margins, but actually, like, his work and others really help us, for me, to make sense of, you know, our racialized identities, how they impact our psyche, how they impact how we relate to others, how they impact how we understand the world. And I think before, my understanding of identity was a very, you know, neoliberal understanding of identity, and racism, I knew and understood it was systemic. Whilst I knew it was systemic, I didn't understand how that showed up. You know, I didn't understand how it impacted my entire degree and all of the scholars that I read, you know, or even if you look at coaching now and you look at the breadth or lack of scholars that influence all of our coaching models and tools. So I think if we could start integrating some of those voices into our work and our thinking, and we can call it decolonizing or we can call it something else, right? It doesn't really matter. It's for me, it's not necessarily a case of getting rid of everything that's already there, because there's some amazing stuff within a coaching space and some amazing thinkers. But I think we're really lacking that breadth and knowledge that I think would make, what do I think it would make? I think it would make coaching, it's not about it, it would make it more accessible, but it would make coaching could become part of the solution rather than part of the problem, I think.
Yeah, no, coaching is massively problematic. It's kind of, I've written a book on coaching and I tried to trace it. And you know, one of the problems with coaching is it comes from the therapeutic milieu, which is fine. You know, I study, I'm a therapist, so I'm not against therapy, but that has a certain way of looking at the world. It has a certain way of kind of individualizing us, of psychologizing us, of kind of like, and it separates you from that social identity. It separates you from the projections of others. It kind of has this idea that we have this kernel of truth within us, and if we only look at that kernel of truth, and you know, so it makes individuals in an organization or an organizational setting, it kind of separates them from the social constructs around them. It separates them from the projections, and it's hugely problematic. It is part of the problem, because you know you get them struggling, and it's unless you see that the social and the unconscious speak through us, that we carry them in us, then you're in trouble.
Well, I think that's the thing, right? That, you know, coaching operates in a kind of decontextualized bubble whereby you learn all of these incredible tools and you go out there wanting to kind of help people to transform their lives or whatever it is, and it's a bit like you forget the reality of what's happening in the world, you know, whether it's the murder of George Floyd or a genocide or whatever it is that's going on. You kind of walk into that room as if you can leave that outside. And I think that's just doing a disservice to our clients and our profession. So I think, it's interesting, because since I've stepped into the space and the work that I do, and it's still very new, you know, I'm in my third year now. Quite often I will speak to coaches who might have an interest in doing some work with me, and they will say, well, I don't really coach black and brown people, so I'm not sure I need to do that work. And it's really interesting, because coaching has almost done such a good job with us to believe that it's neutral and it's apolitical, that quite often there's not even an understanding of what the gap is that this work does. And I think that's a real challenge. You know, the work around, for me, becoming racially conscious isn't about coaching black and brown people. It's about understanding how your own racialized identity might show up, how you operate within this system of power that we all operate in. We just play different roles, how we're socialized into that, how it impacts our worldview. And ultimately, when we start becoming clearer of these things, we can say, okay, so this is my worldview. This is my philosophy. So this is the type of work I want to be doing as a coach. These are the types of tools I should probably be drawing on, where we make choices much more consciously. And I think at the moment, there's probably a lack of consciousness about that, because we kind of go through a bit of a sausage machine, and we all learn the same tools, the same practices, and apply them to people kind of in the same ways. And I think that's great for lots of people, but actually I think on the whole we do a disservice to clients if we haven't done this work.
We do. And Zizek talks about ideology, and ideology is not, you know, we used to think about ideology as sort of the Soviet Union sort of stamping propaganda on us, or like, you know, this big other from the outside. And Zizek says, no, it's actually in us now. Like, you know, it's kind of like it's in us and it's everywhere. And like the coaching ideology is, forget politics, stand outside of social constructs, you know, like just, you know, this is an ideology which is very disempowering, actually. You know, it's very, very dangerous. And, you know, as a white man, I coach all sorts of different people, and I've, you know, recently been doing some work in car manufacturing in the USA, you know, and you've got African-American, like, there's two people I've been thinking of, you know, and they come from very kind of working class families. They've been on a shop floor and they kind of made their way up, you know. And it's interesting being a white coach, because, you know, it's like, do I have permission to ask about race? Do I have, you know, I've learned to be courageous, and I do, you know, so I go out there and I step into that space, and I say, you know, what's your journey been like? You know, what and what's it like now? And suddenly, whoosh, I get this, like, you know, I get this almost like, thank God you asked me, you know, this is like, you know, because I have to hold on to this every day. It's like, you know, every day I come to work and I have to hold on to this stuff and no one ever asked me, you know. And so you open up the space and you realize how much, you know, people carry, you know, on behalf of like, you know, their race, their idea, you know, their identities, you know, what's projected on them, you know, huge amount, you know.
And I think, you know, it does take courage to ask that question and hold that space, right? Because you don't know how it will land with that individual. I think, you know, you're not only an experienced coach, but you're somebody who comes at your work with a critical lens, who's done what I would say is a lot of work on understanding their own identity. And so you have then an ability to hold that space and hopefully hold what might be brought. And I think that for me is about being racially conscious and about being critically conscious, right? And holding whatever comes. I think quite often the challenge from my experience of talking to coaches is that if that question comes, or even if it's offered by the client, is they go straight from body to head thinking, what am I going to say? What language shall I use? Am I going to do this? And in that moment, you are out of flow. You are very much thinking about yourself. You're no longer able to hold that space. Whatever connection was there is lost. And I think that's the challenge. The challenge is, how do you stay in that space and hold that space for whatever that individual might bring? And, you know, I had an experience where I was working with a lady about 18 months ago who, it was very clear she had outlined what the coaching was going to be about, and her organization were paying, and she's a Black woman and she was responsible for DE&I within that organization. And so we had our first session, and within about 15 minutes, the session became all about the racism that she was experiencing within her organization and how overwhelming it was doing the work that she was doing. And it was really interesting for me because I was reflecting afterwards whether or not that would have come on the agenda had I not made space for that. And if I hadn't, what would she have done for her 6 coaching sessions or 10 coaching sessions that she went on to have? How much would she have self-silenced in that space and just talked about what was happening in work, but not really naming what was going on? And I think that that happens a lot within coaching. But the other thing I would say to that is, I think sometimes we can assume that if you're Black or brown, then you are automatically able to either hold that space as a coach or as a client, that's the thing you really want to talk about.
Yeah.
And neither may be true. And so as with any other topic within coaching, it's about trying to hold the space for all of those eventualities. You know, I would say when I was being coached 15 years ago within the corporate space, if somebody had said to me, what's it like being a Black female? I might have kind of said, it's fine. It's kind of, you know, can we get back to talking about the other thing? Or it might have opened something up. I don't know. But it would probably have depended on the relationship between me and that coach at that time. So I think there's uncertainty within coaches and actually supervisors. So coaching taking, you know, some of these challenges to supervisors and supervisors not feeling equipped to hold some of these conversations. And I think that's, there's so much kind of richness that we're missing in terms of supporting individuals and supporting workspaces to navigate all of this stuff at really challenging times, right?
Yeah. I mean, for me, like being a coach, this idea of holding a space, being a container is important. And it is about building a level of trust. You don't go straight into a session and fire away, you know, these kind of high level questions. But once you've got trust, you should feel able to ask things. And if I say to you, Bernice, you know, what's it like being a Black woman in a workspace? And you say, you know, it's not a major issue at the moment, I'd like to talk about something else, and that's cool, you know. It's being able to kind of have those conversations and not be fixated on either speaking about something or not speaking about something. And then the other thing I think, you know, particularly a lot of white coaches and people feel is a huge anxiety around language, you know, getting the DEI language, the LGBTQ+, you know, like the language, getting the pronouns right, all these kind of issues are someone said we've become a nation of stutterers because we're like too afraid to speak about these issues. Now I think it's a good phrase because you witness it, people do kind of stutter, they do kind of Paul said, they are afraid of getting it wrong, you know, and we need to build up this space where there's not a right and a wrong, actually. There's, you know, even in the DEI community, there's many arguments and fights and kind of splits and kind of ideas about what's right and wrong, you know. So it's about having a confident language and holding a space and allowing people to kind of express themselves and discover things.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's, you know, almost what we were touching on before was that idea of building our emotional resilience to kind of hold that space and hold that conversation, but also some racial literacy. So some level of, well, actually, I'm going to use this terminology. So, you know, when I'm working with people in my training, quite often I will refer to the idea of being racialized as Black or racialized as, because it's a reminder that race isn't biological, it's not real, and that sometimes can be helpful. But I don't know, I think there's something about modeling imperfection that I think we could all do a little bit more and kind of say something and go, actually, that felt a bit clumsy. So yeah, I'm going to rephrase that. And that's kind of okay. Because, you know, if you think about whiteness as a system, what's one of the things that it wants us to do? It's kind of this idea of moral perfectionism, that I am not a racist, everything I say will be correct and right. And it's like, actually, we need to actively resist that. So even though there is that urge within all of us, and there is a real cancel culture, it exists, but you know, ultimately you kind of buy into that, or you say, I'm not playing that game. I'm going to do the work that I need to do, so I feel comfortable-ish talking about some of this stuff. And I'm going to seek out spaces and communities where I can practice some of this language and talk about these things, where there is space for nuance, because I think those spaces are getting more and more narrow, aren't they? It's, you know, even we are. And the thing is, you know, you even write a post on LinkedIn and you're like, oh God, you know, there's no space for nuance within some of those conversations. And so I think there is a real kind of push to almost choose sides, isn't it? It's like, you know, if you voted for Trump, you're a racist and you're a bad person, you're all of this. And if you didn't, you're not. And life just is not like that, ultimately. And I think language is doing the same.
Yeah, and it, you know, we do get boxed, and we do, you know, it does feel very like fragile ground we're standing on. You know, if I'm a white man in a certain, if I'm in a kind of a DEI conversation in liberal progressive circles, then I'm sort of a bad object quite often, like, you know, because I carry white maleness, you know, in my body.
And
but that's quite useful. You know, if I can use that usefully and think, well, actually, you know, if you're racialized and then you have a different kind of ethnicity or a marginalized kind of person in a different community. And I know I learned a lot when I was a nurse. I was a male in a female environment. When, you know, you have different experiences as a working class boy to be in academia, you're out of place, you know, you're a space invader. You're like, you know, we all have these kind of experiences, you know, and it's not just kind of one group. And if we can start talking about that and sharing that and learning from it, we can start understanding these issues of identity and power more easily, I think.
Yeah, and how they show up. And actually, you know, I love that idea of space invaders and the somatic norm. It's like how I experienced when I was younger, walking into like a golf club or walking into an art gallery and feeling just out of place. And actually, it's what led me to doing my research in coaching, because when it came to doing my thesis for my master's, I decided to look at what I termed institutional whiteness in coaching. And so the reason I did that was because I wanted to work out why I experienced coaching as quite an embodied white space. So not just white people, but why did I have that kind of general sensation? You know, I could have looked at the idea of institutional racism. I could have, but I felt that if I went down that route, the findings would have led me to the idea of, well, add in some color, add in some diversity. Whereas actually what I wanted to examine was, what are the practices, what are the policies, what's the embedded culture that upholds whiteness in this space? And not only that, they're things that I know I am doing myself. So they're things that, whether you're racialized as white, black or brown, actually these are active things that are present within coaching. And I think that for me was really helpful to start kind of critiquing coaching through that lens, because it was critiquing what was present rather than what was absent. But I love the idea of it's Nima Pawal, isn't it?
Brilliant.
Space Invaders.
Another great book. And for, you know, the audience who don't know it, if you can get that book, Space Invaders, it's really good. And it just talks about how we, you know, in some spaces, different bodies are accepted and those are not accepted, and sort of what we do with that, you know. And it's a question of for yourself, you know, what do you do with that? You know, as a working class boy who's told, you know, left school at 16, ended up in as a professor in academia, you know, that does something to you. It's actually a difficult space to be in. Like, you know, I mean, yes. I remember going to my first ever academic conference, and I was giving a paper, and I stood at the back of the room because I was nervous. And one of the professors came up to me and said, "Waiter, could you pass me a glass of wine, please?" You know, because my black t-shirt and my body language said I'm a waiter. Like, you know, it said, like, you know, I'm not one of you. And it's like, you know, you carry that and you internalize it. And there's voices in our head saying, "You shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be here." Like, you know, don't speak. You shouldn't speak. You know.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and. You know, black
people, I've had exactly the same. You know, I've been in a corporate workplace about to chair a meeting with 15 people, all of them men, all of them white, and somebody asked me if I could get them a tea. And I, little did they know I was the service director and about to sit down and chair this meeting. And I thought, I let them quietly die inside and just carried on with the meeting. But yeah, it's that expectation. You often know what the other might be thinking and how you then manage with how you're feeling, you know, how you're feeling in that moment, as well as how you're potentially being seen by others in that moment. It's very, it can be quite disorientating.
It is. And it's, you know, this is where how Fanon helped me, because, you know, I realized it wasn't, in my case, it wasn't just that black, there wasn't just a professor who kind of like identified me as a working class boy, but it was actually what I was carrying, what I'd internalized. You know,
of course.
I'd internalized that I shouldn't be in that space. You know, that I wasn't worthy. I wasn't kind of, I shouldn't be in that elite space. That was not for people like me, you know. So it's, you know, it's what we carry in our bodies as well, and how we work with that. And
Have you worked, Simon? I'm really interested. How have you worked through that then? What are the techniques or tactics, or how do you process that? Or is it just ever-present?
It's ever-present. I like the, I study psychoanalysis and Lacan, and he helped me because he talked about, like, rather than try and like repair or overcome your symptoms, your problems, it's like put your symptom to work. And this is what I've done. So it's like, you know, using that experience to really inform how I understand working with others has been great. You know, I find it quite amusing now, like my unconscious, you know, when I go, even now I go to some spaces and I still have the bit of the Bristol accent, and I still don't quite feel like I should be there.
I can hear the Bristol accent. Yeah.
Still carry this sort of working class boy in me, you know, who's told he was stupid. You know, there's still part of that in me. I sometimes look at the books I've written and think, where did that come from? And then, oh, that was mine. You know, it's like you bump into yourself, you know, but there's something about kind of being playful with it. So when it began, it was like persecuting, you know, you felt you really shouldn't be in the space, and it was really tough. And then you start playing with it. And actually it's for me, it's like, I see it as sort of data to help me understand situations, you know, why do I feel like in that space, in this certain space, why do I feel in this way? You know, what does it say about me, and what does it say about the space? You know, it's never one thing, you know? So if you use it like a data to try and understand the context you're in, it's actually very, very useful. And that's how I use it now. Like, you know, and, you know, there are tactics, you know, take a deep breath before you go into a meeting, and you say, "Simon, I am good enough." You know, there's all that kind of stuff. Actually, the most important thing for me is to read it as data, to read it as emotional data about what's going on in myself. And in the context, and that is really useful. And sharing that with people, like I'm courageous, and I sort of step out and say, you know, I came into this room and I lost my thought completely. And the reason I lost my thought is because you're all in suits and you're all sat there, and it kind of is an intimidating space. Do you realize that this is an intimidating space of speaking? You know, can we make some sense of that? You know, what do other people feel like? I can't speak in this space. And you start kind of making sense of it with others, and you share it, not in an attacking way. You share it in a curious way. And for me, it's like been really useful.
I love that. That might be something that I try and employ a little bit more. Actually, I presented at a conference last year, and talking about race within coaching, of course, and the conference was, I think everybody in that room was white, probably apart from about 4 or 5 people. And I probably could have named that actually in that moment, but instead I fixated on one black woman sitting in the front row and was like, "I am talking to you," and it was fine and it was all okay. But yeah, it's I like that idea of naming it. I think using it as data is something that I do absolutely. And I think for me, that's why going on this journey, doing my master's, doing my research, doing the work that I do now, has been just so integral to me. Yeah. Kind of understanding me and making sense of me and how I relate to others and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've been on quite a journey, and where's the journey taking you now, Bernice? What's your plans for the next 2 years? You've got
I mean, I think, you know, based on past experience, I quit my job with 2 weeks of thinking it through and going off to do a master's, and I kind of trusted that all would be okay. So I have a degree of trust that things will kind of work themselves out. I very much enjoy having conversations with people like yourself and other people within the coaching space, particularly the critical coaching space, around, you know, what it is we can do. I guess my mission, if you like, is to really kind of be challenging membership bodies and coach training organizations around the things that we could and should be thinking about. And more than that, right, you know, I mean, if I look at workplaces and organizations, I've been on plenty of leadership programs, and there's plenty of leadership programs out there now that will focus on supporting ethnic minorities in the workplace that are no different from the ones that support other leaders within the workplace. And I'm like, well, what are we doing? Like, we're not tailoring them at all. We're not bringing new stuff. We're not supporting in different ways. So I think for me, there's you know, lots of space to bring this idea around consciousness, critical consciousness, racial consciousness to the workplace, to leadership conversations. And I think, you know, the world for many of us feels that there are kind of multiple crises going on. And I think it's a time now where if people are feeling that sense of kind of overwhelm, as I was, you know, back in 2018, 2019, 2020, the best place to start is to start with yourself and to start with kind of making sense of where you are in all of that and what impact you can make. Because I think whilst privilege is a word that I use with a, you know, lowercase p, because it's been, you know, misused and co-opted by many, actually those of us with privilege and with power have great opportunity to go and influence change and make impact. So I am in a position of power, influence and privilege, and I'm trying to use that for, you know, for greater good. Yeah, so the mission hasn't changed, but yeah, it's about connecting with others on that mission, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, just to share, you know, we'd love the Eco Leadership Institute, which I founded and run, you know, we'd love to do some more work with you, building these collaborations, building these ecosystems of change. You know, I think for me, like, the way things are going to change in the world are because through building networks and ecosystems, you know, not from top down. So, you know, building these relationships and doing this kind of work is really, really important. So keep going and let's do some work together. I finished the podcast probably with two questions. What does it mean to live a good life? And what does it mean to build a good society? They're big questions, but you've got quite a lot of life experience. Any thoughts?
What does it mean to live a good life? Wow. I wish I knew that those were the questions at the end of the podcast. I haven't been paying attention, and I did listen to some as well. What does it mean to live a good life? I think for me, it is to live an authentic life. I think it's Gabor Mate who talks about this idea of having to choose between assimilation and authenticity, and you kind of can't have both. I did the assimilating thing. It didn't lead to happiness. And so for me, it's about living a really authentic life and kind of owning who I am and the skills I have and everything else. What was the second question?
How can we create a good society? What does that mean, like, to create a better society?
What does it mean to create a better society? I think it means paying attention. I think it means talking to our neighbours. I think it means connecting with people who are different from ourselves. Many of us live in echo chambers, right? Even, you know, I notice it on LinkedIn that many of the people we're connected with think the same things, like the same things. And so we can think that that's the only way there is in the world. But actually, the more that we can connect across difference, then I think the happier and healthier the world would be.
Wise advice. Bernice, thank you very much. It's been really lovely talking to you. Keep the good work going, and we'll do some work together.
Thanks, Simon. I've really enjoyed this. Take care.
Thank you all. And just to say to the listeners, I've been talking about coaching. We are actually running a critical coaching program starting in September. It's a diploma, accredited. If you're interested, get in touch with the Eco Leadership Institute. Thanks for listening.